From San Francisco, this is Democracy Now!
Recording devices in the Oval Office or in the residence?
As I said for the third time, there is nothing further to add on that.
Does he think it's appropriate to threaten someone like Mr. Comey not to speak?
I don't think that's not a threat. He's simply stated a fact. The tweet speaks for itself. I'm moving on.
As the scandal over the firing of FBI Director James Comey grows, are we seeing the beginning of the end of the Trump presidency? President Trump has suggested he secretly recorded his conversations with Comey. We'll look at the fall of President Richard Nixon, whose secret tapes led to his resignation. And we'll speak with former Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman, the youngest member to serve on the House Judiciary Committee that voted to impeach Nixon. Then we look at Attorney General Jeff Sessions' escalation of the war on drugs.
Going forward, I have empowered our prosecutors to charge and pursue the most serious offense, as I believe the law requires, most serious, readily provable offense.
As a massive Palestinian prisoner hunger strike enters its 28th day, we'll speak to the son of strike leader Marwan Barghouti, a leading Palestinian political figure who's been imprisoned in Israeli jails for over 15 years. Marwan Barghouti has been called the Palestinian Nelson Mandela.
My father, along with 1,700 Palestinian political prisoners, started the hunger strike for freedom and dignity, in demand of basic rights and humanitarian living conditions in the prisons.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from San Francisco. A global computer hack using a cyber weapon developed by the National Security Agency has disrupted hospitals, universities, government offices, gas stations, ATM machines, and more than 200,000 computers worldwide. And it's expected to grow worse as people return to work this morning. On Friday, the cyber attacks began to ripple through more than 150 countries, locking medical workers out of the computer systems at dozens of British and Indonesian hospitals, disrupting train schedules in Germany, preventing Chinese students from accessing their final papers, and freezing government computers from Russia's interior ministry to police stations in India. Experts say it's the first time a cyber weapon developed by the NSA has been stolen and released by hackers. The cyber weapon exploits weaknesses in Microsoft software. It appears the U.S. government knew for years about this weakness in the software, but only told Microsoft about the vulnerability recently, meaning Microsoft had little time to fix the problem and for software users worldwide to update their systems. The cyber weapon is transmitted by email, then encrypts a computer, locking people out of their data, then threatening to destroy it unless a ransom is paid. On Sunday, Microsoft President Brad Smith confirmed the cyber weapon used in the attack was developed by the NSA, writing, quote, "Finally, this attack provides yet another example of why the stockpiling of vulnerabilities by governments is such a problem. An equivalent scenario with conventional weapons would be the U.S. military having some of its Tomahawk missiles stolen," unquote. NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden tweeted, quote, "Despite warnings, NSA.gov built dangerous attack tools that could target Western software. Today we see the cost," unquote. On Capitol Hill, U.S. lawmakers are demanding President Trump turn over any recordings of conversations he had with fired FBI Director James Comey. The demand comes after President Trump threatened Comey in a Twitter rant on Friday, writing, quote, "James Comey better hope that there are no tapes of our conversations before he starts leaking to the press," unquote. Late last week, Trump acknowledged in an NBC interview that he'd fired Comey in part over the FBI investigation into whether the Trump campaign colluded with Russia to allegedly hack the 2016 election. Comey has been invited to meet with the Senate Intelligence Committee on Tuesday. Democrats have said they will not vote on a new FBI director until a special prosecutor is appointed to preside over the investigation into Trump's ties to Russia. On Sunday, former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper said Trump's decision to fire Comey represents an assault on U.S. institutions.
I think in many ways our institutions are under assault, both externally, and that's the big news here is the Russian interference in our election system. And I think as well our institutions are under assault internally.
Internally from the president?
Exactly.
The New York Times reports Senate Republicans are starting to distance themselves from President Trump amid increasing frustration about the firing of James Comey. On Thursday, Maine Senator Susan Collins said, quote, it does seem like we have an upheaval, a crisis almost every day in Washington. President Trump threatened Friday to end daily news briefings, suggesting he may simply host his own news conference every few weeks. On Twitter, Trump also acknowledged White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer and Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders have issued false statements to the press in the last week, writing, quote, as a very active president with lots of things happening, it's not possible for my surrogates to stand at the podium with perfect accuracy, unquote. Meanwhile, lawn ornaments have begun popping up, depicting White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer hiding among the bushes. After Spicer spent several minutes attempting to hide himself in the shrubbery outside the White House while Sarah Huckabee Sanders and Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway were doing interviews on Tuesday about the firing of James Comey. Unnamed officials say the White House is close to finalizing an arms deal worth $100 billion with Saudi Arabia ahead of Trump's planned visit to Riyadh on Friday, the first stop on Trump's first international trip as president. After Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, Trump will visit Israel and then the Vatican. North Korea launched a new ballistic missile Sunday morning. The missile flew 430 miles, North Korea says. The United States military bases across the Pacific are now within striking range and that the missile is designed to carry a nuclear warhead. The test comes amidst rising tensions between North Korea and the United States, tensions that were also fueled by the U.S.'s massive spring military drills on the Korean Peninsula. In a major immigrants' rights victory, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials have granted stays of deportation to two prominent undocumented Denver residents, Jeanette Vizguera and Arturo Hernandez Garcia. Vizguera sought sanctuary in the First Unitarian Society of Denver Church shortly after Trump took office. She's one of the founders of the Metro Denver Sanctuary Coalition and was recently named one of Time magazine's 100 Most Influential People of 2017. This is Jeanette Vizguera speaking on Friday morning after she left the church for the first time in 86 days.
Hoy es un día especial para mí.
It's a special day for me.
Porque voy a poder celebrar el Día de las Madres con mis hijos.
Because I will be able to celebrate Mother's Day with my children.
Y mis nietos.
And my grandchildren.
Arturo Hernandez Garcia spent 9 months in the same sanctuary church 2 years ago. He was recently arrested by ICE, even though the Obama administration had told him he was not considered a priority for removal. Meanwhile, in Vermont, 23-year-old activist and dairy worker Cesar Alex Carrillo has been deported. Carrillo was arrested in March along with two other activists with the group Migrant Justice, Enrique Bacazar and Zuli Palacios. Carrillo was deported to Mexico on a so-called voluntary departure order, which will give him a better chance of being allowed to return to the U.S. to reunite with his wife and their 4-year-old daughter, Sol Marie. To see our full coverage of Jeanette Vizguera, Arturo Hernandez Garcia and Cesar Alex Carrillo, you can go to democracynow.org. Meanwhile, in Atlanta, another immigration activist, dreamer Jessica Clotel, is fighting her possible deportation after the Trump administration revoked her DACA status, which gives her permission to live, work and study in the United States. In 2010, while Clotel was a student at Kennesaw State University, she was arrested, jailed for 37 days and threatened with deportation for driving without a license. After a successful campaign by her fellow students to win her freedom, she became one of the faces of the movement to pass the DREAM Act to protect undocumented students. Clotel is now working as an immigration paralegal, and she's suing to get her DACA reinstated. In Yemen, officials have declared a state of emergency in the capital, Sana'a, over a cholera outbreak that has already killed 115 people. Yemen's health, water and sanitation services have been severely impacted by the ongoing U.S.-backed Saudi-led war on Yemen. This is Dr. Hussein Al-Haddad, the director of one of the few hospitals in Sana'a that is still functioning.
What This situation is very bad. The children that are suffering from cholera are countless, and there aren't enough beds. The technical know-how in the hospital is also insufficient to deal with the situation we are facing.
In Pakistan, at least 25 people were killed and 30 more were wounded in an attack targeting the convoy of a senior Pakistani politician in the southwest province of Balochistan on Friday. ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack, but local officials have blamed local militants. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the World Health Organization says Ebola has killed at least three people in the past 3 weeks, raising fears of another widespread outbreak on the continent. In 2014, Ebola killed more than 11,000 people across West Africa. In northern Mexico, an activist for parents whose children have gone missing was assassinated by armed gunmen Wednesday, Mother's Day in Mexico. Miriam Rodriguez was the director of the San Fernando Collective of Missing People. Her own daughter, Karen, had gone missing in 2012. Meanwhile, in the southern state of Guerrero, a group of reporters was attacked, robbed, and threatened by a group of armed men Saturday. The attack occurred outside Iguala, where 43 students were disappeared from the Ayotzinapa Teachers College in 2014. The journalists who all survived the attack said the men threatened to burn them alive. In Hong Kong, three families who offered refuge to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden when he was in hiding in 2013 are facing possible deportation after their asylum claims were rejected. The families are from the Philippines and Sri Lanka. Their lawyers say Hong Kong authorities intentionally targeted the three families for expedited immigration screening. And in Charlottesville, Virginia, dozens of torch-bearing white nationalists gathered Saturday for two rallies to protest plans to remove a Confederate monument. White nationalist Richard Spencer led the protesters, who chanted, "We will not be replaced," while the torch-bearing mob evoked the long, bloody history of white terrorism against African Americans. Some took to Twitter to mock Spencer and the other white nationalists for using party story-style tiki torches at the rally. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're on the road in San Francisco. I'll be speaking today in Santa Cruz and in Palo Alto. Fallout continues to grow over President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey last week. The firing came just days after Comey requested more resources to probe Russia's meddling in the 2016 election. The Senate Democrats are now threatening to refuse to vote on a new FBI director unless a special prosecutor is named to investigate possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russia. On Sunday, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer appeared on Meet the Press.
A special prosecutor appointed by the Justice Department has the ability to actually prosecute people for violations of law. And they go on in tandem. One shouldn't step on the other. I know they're talking to each other right now. The FBI was with the Intelligence Committee to make sure no one's granted immunity. But it's two separate issues. And we very much need a special prosecutor, Chuck. We need someone who's independent of the Justice Department to get to the bottom of this.
On the same program, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson admitted Russia did, in fact, interfere with the election.
I have seen the intelligence reports, Chuck, and yes, I don't think there's any question that the Russians were playing around in our electoral processes. Again, and as those intelligence reports also have indicated, it's inconclusive as to what, if any, effect it had.
Meanwhile, pressure is growing on the administration to reveal whether Trump has been secretly recording conversations at the White House. On Friday, Trump tweeted, "James Comey better hope that there are no tapes of our conversations before he starts leaking to the press," unquote. Lawmakers are now calling on Trump to hand over any such tapes. On Friday, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer refused to rule out the existence of the tapes.
Moving on to the news of the week, really, and the day, did President Trump record his conversations with former FBI Director Comey?
I assume you're referring to his tweet. The tweet. And I've talked to the president. The president has nothing further to add on that.
Why did he say that? Why did he tweet that? What should we interpret from that?
As I mentioned, the president has nothing further to add on that.
Are there recording devices in the Oval Office or in the residence?
As I said for the third time, there is nothing further to add on that.
Does he think it's appropriate to threaten someone like Mr. Comey not to speak?
I don't think that's not a threat. He's simply stated a fact. The tweet speaks for itself. I'm moving on.
President Trump's possible recording of White House conversations has led many comparisons between Trump and former President Richard Nixon, who resigned August 8, 1974, 3 days after the release of an audio recording of Nixon discussing the Watergate break-in. Nixon had fought off congressional subpoenas to release the tape, but eventually the Supreme Court forced him to hand it over. It later became known as the smoking gun tape. We're joined now by Elizabeth Holtzman, former U.S. Congresswoman from New York, who served on the House Judiciary Committee that voted to impeach Richard Nixon. Liz Holtzman, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the significance of what President Trump threatened in one of his tweet storms against James Comey after he fired him as FBI director?
Well, the threat is an absurdity. The president was saying that Comey should hope that there was no tape recording before he talks about the meeting. The president knows whether there's a tape recording or not. He's the one who knows. So this is just nonsense. If President Trump wants the truth out, if Comey was lying about the meeting, the president should just release the tape. He's just playing games with the American people. The real connection with Watergate is the firing of Comey by President Trump, which appears to be, on the face of it and given all the circumstance around it, an effort to cover up and to prevent an investigation of whether Russia colluded with him and his campaign over interference in the American election, and whether he's still colluding with the Russians. I mean, what's involved in the firing is a question, really, of whether we have a president of the United States who is under the influence of and working in collusion with the president of a hostile foreign government. And we've got to get to the bottom of that. And Trump's actions prevent us, at this point, from making sure that we can get the truth.
I want to turn to an interview last week when Donald Trump once again changed his story about why he fired FBI Director James Comey, admitting on NBC he made the decision in part due to Comey's probe of Russia's meddling in the 2016 election. Trump's comment directly contradicts numerous statements by White House aides, as well as Trump's own claims that he had fired Comey over his handling of the investigation into Hillary Clinton and her use of private email servers.
But regardless of recommendation, I was going to fire Comey, knowing there was no good time to do it. And in fact, when I decided to just do it, I said to myself, I said, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election that they should have won.
So can you talk about this, Liz Holtzman, the astounding original story that President Trump did not appreciate how Hillary Clinton was treated, although throughout the campaign, he congratulated James Comey for going after Clinton?
Look, everything we've seen about Trump, and I won't go elsewhere, but in this, in connection with the firing of Comey, has been just one misstatement, one pretext, one lie after the other. It's totally incredible to think that President Trump was so concerned about Comey's treatment of Hillary Clinton that he fired him months later for doing that. It's just nobody can believe that. What really was at stake, and we know that later, he said, I made up my mind before I ever heard from the Justice Department. I was going to fire him anyway. And what was on his mind when he fired him? The Russian investigation. And Trump has been attacking this Russian investigation from the get-go. He even called the CIA Nazis over that. So we know he's not happy about that, and he wanted to stop it. And that stopping that could mean that we have in place a president of the United States in cahoots with the Russian government at this very moment.
I want to turn to Senator Mark Warner, Virginia Democrat, speaking on Fox News Sunday about Trump's threat of a tape of a conversation with James Comey.
This sure seems to have reverberations of past history. When we've seen presidents who secretly tape, that usually does not end up being a good outcome for a president. The whole notion that the president can throw out these kind of claims and then not either confirm or deny them is outrageous in my mind. And if there is the existence of tapes, I want to make sure, one, they're preserved and not mysteriously destroyed in the coming days. And then, two, one way or the other, Congress will have to get a look at those tapes.
So that was Senator Warren. If you, Senator Warner of Virginia, Elizabeth Holtzman, take us back through what happened to Richard Nixon. You know, there are a lot of references, including the Saturday Night Massacre, and parallels have been made to what happened with the firing of James Comey. But especially for young people, to understand what happened then, also how long it took. Explain the chronology when you were a young congresswoman from New York serving, what, the youngest member to serve on the House Judiciary Committee.
Okay, I'll try to do this in 25 words or less. Basically, in June of 1972, there was a break-in into the Democratic National Committee headquarters. People were apprehended, and they were connected to Richard Nixon's campaign and to the White House. Nixon had a special surveillance operation in the White House that was illegal from the get-go. These people were caught, and Nixon was terrified that they would get to the presidency and that his election in November would be jeopardized. So they had this big cover-up, and that worked. Nixon was reelected in 1972 in November with one of the biggest margins in electoral history. After that, the burglars cracked. One of them said, yeah, there were higher-ups involved. And then you start to have investigations. And Richard Nixon had a taping system in the White House. In August of 1973, the taping system became public because you had a bipartisan Senate investigation, Senate Watergate Committee, and they asked, are there tapes? And the person who set up the taping system said there were tapes. President Nixon, for reasons that are still not understood, had a full taping system in the Oval Office and a few other places, and he tape-recorded all the conversations. And at that time, the question was, did Nixon participate in the cover-up or not? And the tapes could prove it. And there was a special prosecutor who was appointed, and the special prosecutor wanted to get the tapes. And that was in October of 1973, the special prosecutor said, I'm getting the tapes, and Nixon had the special prosecutor fired. He said, you're not getting my tapes. Well, Nixon knew what was on the tapes, just as if there are tapes with regard to Trump. Trump knows exactly what's on them. Nixon knew exactly what was on them, and he said, you are not getting these tapes because the tapes were incriminating. And there was a big fight over that in the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ultimately required the tapes to be released. And the tapes showed, without any question, out of Richard Nixon's own mouth, that he obstructed justice and he ordered the Watergate cover-up from the, almost the day that the break-in took place. So you have a repetition of a president claiming there was a tape recording system, and the tapes could exonerate him or not. But my view is that Comey not only is a very careful prosecutor and would never have said things that were improper in that meeting with Trump, but I'm sure he suspected that he could have been tape recorded, so he was doubly or triply careful. But the person who knows whether they're tapes and what's on those tapes is the president, and why is he playing games with the American people over this issue?
Just to be clear, the issue isn't so much that he tapes, but that it was incriminating that he what he taped. That's
Absolutely.
What he was concerned about being replaced. So let me ask you, does every president tape in the Oval Office?
Well, I hope not, but we know that there are a few who did. We know Nixon had the most elaborate system, but I also believe that Johnson had some kind of taping system. I don't know if it was as systematic as this, but he had some kind of taping system. I mean, systematic as Nixon's. And I think after Nixon, people didn't want to touch it.
Hmm. I want to turn to a conversation we had in February with President Richard Nixon's White House counsel, John Dean. I asked him about where Trump stood just over a month into his presidency in comparison with his boss, Richard Nixon.
If you recall, Watergate ran about 900 days. In other words, it went on for years, starting with a bungled burglary at the Democratic National Committee and right up to Richard Nixon's resignation followed by the conviction of his top aides. So it ran a long time. What we're seeing is very accelerated. It's partially responsible because of the media and the technology today, but it's also the behavior of Trump and his aides, as well as the media's vigilance on this. So we're seeing things accelerated. And what I see or hear are echoes of Watergate. We don't have Watergate 2.0 yet, but we have something that is beginning to look like it could go there.
That was John Dean. Your response, Liz Holtzman, and interesting, to say the least, you were on very different sides back in the 70s when you were congressman and John Dean worked for Nixon. But you may share a lot of views right now.
Yes, I think we're getting very close to Watergate. I think Donald Trump is deep into Watergate territory. I think the firing of James Comey with the apparent intention to squelch an investigation into his campaign activities and his activities resonates deeply with the issues in Watergate. But I just want to make one point about what Dean said. When Richard Nixon took office, it was only a matter of 2 or 3 months before he started into his illegal activities. The illegal bombing of Cambodia started in March of his first year in office. And that was a war crime and a crime against the Constitution. Unfortunately, Nixon wasn't impeached for that. There was no vote to impeach him for that. But let's not get carried away with how Nixon was really a good guy up to the very end. He wasn't. The bad stuff started right away. The plumber's unit started right away. Illegal surveillance started right away. So I think we have here a similar kind of idea that that the president is above the law. And once you get that idea in your head, then that's trouble, not just for the president, but for the American people.
Elizabeth Holtzman, last question in this last minute, and that was when the Republicans turned on Richard Nixon, the Republicans in Congress, and talk about what you're seeing today. Because many say with the Republican majority in both houses, there's just no way that President Trump would be impeached.
Well, I think what happened during Watergate was that the checks and balances system worked. It worked for the judiciary. The first person who stood up was a very conservative Republican judge, John Sirica, who smelled something wrong with the burglary and imposed very tough sentences because he knew there was something fishy going on. And as a result of that, one of the burglars broke and said higher-ups were involved. That really led to the whole rest of the investigation. The second thing was when you had the Senate Select Committee on Watergate. You had Sam Ervin, who was a Democrat, Southern Democrat, a constitutional scholar, was the chair. And Howard Baker, a Republican from Tennessee, was the vice chair. And he started out as a total partisan for Richard Nixon. And he came up with a series of questions. What does the president know, and when does he know it? And he thought those questions would show that Nixon had nothing to do with the break-in, with the cover-up. And so he asked those questions of the witnesses. And when he asked those questions, the answers repeated and repeated and repeated showed that Nixon was aware, the White House was aware, and showed his involvement. As a result of the facts, Baker became an advocate for the rule of law. On the House side, the House Judiciary Committee, I think at the beginning, most of the Republicans, if not all of them, were advocates for the president. But the facts came out, and in the end, most of the Republicans voted for the articles of impeachment because they put country above party. In the end, all of them, when the smoking gun tape came out, as you said, all of the Republicans announced that they were going to be in favor of impeachment, even those who had voted against it, very conservative Republicans. Why'd they do that? Because the facts were clear, the Constitution was clear, the law was clear. And I'm hoping that that will happen here. It may take longer for Republicans to come to their senses on this, but they did in Watergate. And let's not lose hope. They take an oath to uphold the Constitution. And they had the opportunity to protect the Constitution against a president who's got no respect for it, no respect for the rule of law.
Elizabeth Holtzman, I want to thank you for being with us. Former U.S. Congresswoman from New York served on the House Judiciary Committee that voted to impeach Richard Nixon. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we talk about Jeff Sessions escalating the war on drugs in this country. The Attorney General of the United States. Stay with us.
We have had a stone salt picnic at the park. Nappy haired, proud brown people singing in the dark. We had a stone salt picnic at the park. Barefoot, breathing heavily as we run. Barefoot, breathing heavily, playing soccer in the sun. We had a stone salt picnic at the park. Smile, smile, smile on. Beautiful people always smiling, showing their teeth that shine, shine. Sweat on her brow, falling, kissing the earth that shakes, because it feels warm inside. Oh yes, it moves us, placing happiness in our souls, placing happiness in our can feel as we look into each other's eyes, and then we get lost, we disappear like flies.
Stone Soul Picnic by Chicano Batman here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from San Francisco as we continue to travel the country covering the movements changing America. We turn right now to the Trump administration's escalation of the war on drugs. On Friday, Attorney General Sessions spoke at the Department of Justice headquarters as he rescinded two Obama-era memos that encourage prosecutors to avoid seeking inordinately harsh sentences for low-level drug offenses.
Going forward, I have empowered our prosecutors to charge and pursue the most serious offense, as I believe the law requires, most serious, readily provable offense. It means that we're going to meet our responsibility to enforce the law with judgment and fairness. It is simply the right and moral thing to do. And we know that drugs and crime go hand in hand. They just do. The facts prove that so. Drug trafficking is an inherently dangerous and violent business. If you want to collect a drug debt, you can't file a lawsuit in court. You collect it with the barrel of a gun.
Jeff Sessions has long backed lengthy prison sentences and mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes, including for marijuana use, which is now legal for either medical or recreational purposes in many states. Sessions' escalation of the so-called war on drugs was met with widespread outcry. Former Attorney General Eric Holder, who served under President Obama, told MSNBC in a statement, "The policy announced today is not tough on crime, it's dumb on crime." Under the Obama administration guidelines, the number of drug offenders given mandatory minimum sentences plummeted, contributing to a 14% decline in the total federal prison population. Sessions' announcement comes at a time of growing bipartisan support for sentencing reform. In recent years, the liberal-leaning Center for American Progress and the right-leaning Freedom Works have partnered with groups as varied as the Koch Industries and the NAACP to bridge ideological divides and push for reduced mandatory minimums for low-level nonviolent drug offenses. Well, for more, we're joined by two guests in New York. Anthony Pappas, author of This Side of Freedom, Life After Clemency. He's an anti-drug war activist, painter, and author. In 1985, Anthony Pappas agreed to deliver an envelope of cocaine in a police sting operation in return for $500. His first and only criminal offense cost him a 15-year-to-life sentence. In 1996, Papa won a sentence commutation from then-New York Governor George Pataki. In 2016, Papa received a pardon from New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. He's believed to be the first person in New York State history to receive both a sentence commutation and a pardon. And we're joined by Carl Hart, chair of the Department of Psychology and a professor of psychiatry at Columbia University. He's the author of High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery That Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. Professor Hart just returned from the Philippines, where he participated in a two-day drug policy forum conference. Tony Papa, Carl Hart, welcome to Democracy Now! Carl Hart, first respond to what Jeff Sessions is doing, this escalation of the war on drugs in the United States.
Let's just be clear. I mean, one of the things that people—we've heard some outrage about what Jeff Sessions is doing, but let's be clear. Everybody knows that the war on drugs, as it's been fought since the 1980s, has had this disproportionate negative impact on specific communities, Black communities, Latino communities. Everyone knows that. So what Jeff Sessions is doing is engaged in, or he's advocating, being engaged in racial discrimination. So let's call Jeff Sessions what he is. Jeff Sessions is a racist if he takes on this action. It's clear. We know it. So let's stop playing around with it.
So, Anthony Papa, what is your understanding of what the Attorney General is calling for right now?
Well, you know, Amy, I agree with Eric Holder. This is totally dumb on crime. To go back to a proven failed policy and to enact, tell prosecutors to convict people at the harshest sentence is totally wrong. I'll use myself as an example. You know, first-time nonviolent offender, I was actually sentenced to 215-to-life sentences under the Rockefeller drug laws in New York State, which was mandated by mandatory minimum sentencing, the same mandatory minimum sentencing laws that became in the federal system, that now Sessions wants to prosecutors to use to sentence even low-level nonviolent drug offenders or even people who were addicted to drugs to many, many years in prison. It's a proven fact that this policy wasted billions of dollars, and more importantly, many human lives were wasted in this action in the past.
I want to go back to Carl Hart. So Attorney General Jeff Sessions has released this memo that tells Justice Department prosecutors to pursue the most serious charges for drug offenses. So explain exactly how this changes policy and what it will mean.
Well, what it means is that as you know, under Eric Holder has suggested, or his memo said that we shouldn't engage in those mandatory minimums. So he gave judges flexibility, whereas Jeff Sessions is encouraging the judges to go back to mandatory minimum. What that means is that people will get harsher sentences for drug-related violations. Now, and what that means ultimately, as Papa has said, we all know the drug war didn't work. That's not entirely true, because the drug war did work for certain segments of our population. And that's where the crux of this policy really needs to be integrated. Jeff Sessions is allowing us, or is using drug policy to separate the people who we like from the people who we don't like. And it provides a way to go after those people we don't like, usually poor minority folks, without explicitly saying we don't like those people. And that's how drug law or drug policy has been enforced in this country. And so if we allow Sessions to turn back the hands of time, then shame on all of us. The blood is on all of our hands, because we know the consequences of his proposed actions.
You know, Jeff Sessions' view on drugs have a long history. He famously was quoted as joking in the 1980s about the white terrorist organization, the KKK, that he thought they were okay until he said, "I found out they smoke pot." Your response to this, Carl?
Well, that's an interesting thing, because one of the things that has happened in the country since that time, we now have 8 states that have legalized recreational marijuana use. And those states were concerned that Jeff Sessions would come after them, on the one hand. Jeff Sessions has not come after them because there's a lot of money involved and there are a lot of wealthy white people involved in that. Now, I don't want to pit white people against other groups in the country, but let's just be honest about this. And he won't go after them. I know people have some anxieties about that, but Jeff Sessions is ignorant, but he's not stupid. And so he won't go after those folks. So even though he made his comment about marijuana, we should see actually what his actions are. I mean, he can make these comments to kind of give a wink and nod to the people who are supporting him, so he lets them know that I'm against drugs, but he's not going after marijuana. He's going after all the other sort of drug offenses. And I hope the people who are engaged in the marijuana industry and this business make the connection about how their substance was once vilified. It's no longer vilified in the United States, particularly as these states liberalize their marijuana policy. I wish they make the connection so they can see the hypocrisy. Like, before 2012, we were arresting people for marijuana in Colorado and Washington and those other states. We're no longer doing that. Now we're saying it's okay. It was always okay. It's just that our laws were not in line. Now we're arresting people for things like cocaine, heroin, and those sorts of things, sending people to jail for extended periods of time. Now, this is not to say that we should legalize drugs. That's not the argument here. We certainly should not be sending people to jail for those extended periods that Jeff Sessions is advocating for. And he's doing so because he's going at the people who we don't care for in the United States.
In a statement, Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul criticized Sessions' change in drug policy. Paul, who's a doctor, said, quote, "Mandatory minimum sentences have unfairly and disproportionately incarcerated too many minorities for too long. Attorney General Sessions' new policy will accentuate that injustice." Rand added, "Instead, we should treat our nation's drug epidemic as a health crisis and less as a lock-'em-up-and-throw-away-the-key problem." That's the Republican Senator Rand Paul, Dr. Hart.
I agree with Rand Paul on that point. But, you know, we have to be careful about our language in terms of epidemic, because all of those sorts of things kind of provide cover for folks to behave like Jeff Sessions. If we're really concerned, for example, like the opioids and heroin, we need to tell people how to stay safe. If we're worried about overdose death, about 13,000 people die every year from heroin-related overdoses, whereas 35,000 people die from automobile accidents. We don't ban automobiles. Instead, we have regulations, and we try to make sure that people stay safe. We have speed limits. We have seat belts. We have all of these sorts of things. But with the opioids, we're talking about arresting people. And by the way, for the opioids at the federal level, 80% of the people who are arrested are Latino and Black. And we know this. If we want to be smart or if we want to save our people or help people, we would not take the approach of someone like Jeff Sessions, who wants to take us back to the 1980s and experience all the bad things of the 80s.
Anthony Papa, before we go, can you briefly tell us what happened to you? The amount of time you served in prison, and what this change could mean now?
Well, I spent 12 years of a 15-to-life sentence for a first-time nonviolent drug offense. And, you know, I brought an envelope with 4 ounces of cocaine from the Bronx to Mount Vernon, was roped into a police sting operation. 20 cops came out of nowhere, placed under arrest, did everything I could do wrong, and I wound up getting sentenced to 215-to-life sentence for a first-time nonviolent drug offense under the mandatory provisions of the Rockefeller drug laws. The mandatory minimum sentencing is a poison that has broken the criminal justice system. This is a fact. Under President Obama, he tried to fix this broken system by incorporating changes. And Eric Holder, in his memo in 2013, said to prosecutors, don't use mandatory minimum sentencing laws. Now, Sessions is reversing this policy, and we're in for a hard, hard, long row to hoe, because people are going to be put in prison, nonviolent offenders. The prisons are going to be flooded. They're going to break the banks of many states in the federal system, incarcerating low-level nonviolent drug offenders. And many of those offenders have substance abuse problems, and they needed to be treated medically, not punitively. And to have Sessions come out with this law is a travesty of justice. And I hope that they realize this mistake and they don't follow through on this this memo that he wrote telling prosecutors to use mandatory minimum sentencing laws and to throw the book at low-level nonviolent drug offenders, no matter, you know, how small the crime is.
And finally, Dr. Carl Hart, I want to ask you about the Philippines, where you just came back from. President Trump recently visited, invited Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte to visit the White House, despite massive criticism from human rights groups over Duterte's so-called war on drugs, during which thousands of people have been extrajudicially killed by police and vigilantes. Can you tell us what you found there?
When I was in the Philippines, the thing that I discovered is that it's a lot worse than I originally thought it was. Duterte operates in intimidation. And so not only is he the problem, but there are other political officials who are afraid to speak out. They are the problem. And Duterte has taken a page out of the 1980s U.S. drug war in that he's using drugs to separate people, the issue of drugs to separate the poor people from the people who have means. And he is allowing or providing the environment so people could kill, as you pointed out, kill people who are engaged in drug use and in drug trafficking. People are afraid to speak out against this wrong because Duterte has no qualms about having people's lives be threatened. In fact, I discovered that people are being killed for as little as $100. It ranges from about $100 to $500 to have someone killed. Actually, I left the Philippines early because my life was threatened because of me speaking out against what Duterte was saying about drugs and what he's doing. We have it bad in the United States, but the Philippines, I have never seen anything like the Philippines.
Professor Hart, explain more what happened to you, and then your response to President Trump, to the shock of many, inviting the Philippines President Duterte to the White House.
So I gave a talk basically saying that what Duterte had said, he said that methamphetamine shrinks your brain. And this provided justification for people to kill people who use methamphetamine. And I said that was ludicrous. There's no science to support that. He was upset about it. He responded. His people online, they responded with threats and that sort of thing. I didn't think my statement was controversial, but turns out it was, because this is justification for killing people. For Trump to invite Duterte to the United States, given that this sort of thing is happening, it's just consistent with what Trump has been doing. Trump has been shown himself to be the most ignorant president that we've ever had. He has shown himself to be the one that disregards law more so than any other president we've had. So it's just consistent. It would be nice if Democrats and people who are in power, particularly people in, who know something about the law, to figure out a legal way to restrain him or get rid of him. It's just inappropriate for him to behave like that at that level.
Professor Carl Hart, I want to thank you for being with us. Chair of the Department of Psychology, professor of psychiatry at Columbia University, author of High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. Professor Hart just returned from the Philippines, where he was threatened with his life. And Anthony Papa, thanks so much for being with us, author of This Side of Freedom, Life After Clemency, anti-drug war activist, painter, and author. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the massive Palestinian hunger strike, we'll speak with the son of the leader of that strike. the son of Marwan Barghouti, who's been imprisoned by Israel for more than 15 years. Stay with us. Something Inside So Strong, performed by Terry O'Neill. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. I'm here in San Francisco. We'll be speaking in Santa Cruz and in Palo Alto, and then we're on to San Diego and Los Angeles. But right now, we're going to talk with a guest here in San Francisco. It's been almost a month since over 1,500 Palestinian prisoners have been on hunger strike inside Israeli jails. The strike, which began April 17th, was called by Marwan Barghouti to protest poor living conditions in prison and the administrative detention law, which allows Palestinians to be held without charge. Barghouti is the most high-profile Palestinian in Israeli detention. In a New York Times op-ed announcing the strike last month, Marwan Barghouti wrote, quote, "Having spent the last 15 years in an Israeli prison, I've been both a witness to and a victim of Israel's illegal system of mass arbitrary arrests and ill treatment of Palestinian prisoners. After exhausting all other options, I decided there was no choice but to resist these abuses by going on a hunger strike." Well, to talk more about the hunger strike and Marwan Barghouti, who's been described as many as Palestinian Nelson Mandela, we're joined now by his son, Arab Barghouti, recently launched the Saltwater Challenge, asking supporters to express their solidarity with the hunger strikers by posting videos online drinking salt water. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Arab Barghouti. Why drink salt water?
Well, thank you, first of all, for having me. Salt water is the only thing that these prisoners are living on. They haven't taken anything other than the Sultan water, and it's a symbolic act, and we just wanted to be creative outside of the box to raise the awareness and let everyone know what is going on. It's been going well, and it went viral in the Arab world, and here it's growing more and more.
Arab, tell us about your father, Marwan Barghouti.
Well, my father is a political leader that has been struggling and fighting for his freedom and his people's freedom for more than four decades. He spent more than 21 years of his life in Israeli jails, was kicked out of Palestine for 7 years. He was elected twice for as a member of the Palestinian parliament, and he's a member of the Central Committee of Fatah, which is the highest committee of Fatah Party. My father is very well supported nationally and internationally. He's supported by icons like Nelson Mandela himself, who met with my mother and showed his support to my father's campaign, international campaign for his release. The former U.S. President Jimmy Carter happens to be one of the biggest supporters of my father and sent us a video asking for the release of Marwan Barghouti personally. My father is nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by seven times. Two of the Nobel Prize laureates just did the saltwater challenge and happened to be one of the main supporters of my father.
So talk about why your father, Marwan Barghouti, started this hunger strike.
Because, as he said, he exhausted all the ways to negotiate with the Israeli prison authorities on their very basic human rights. And this is exactly why the hunger strike is called the Freedom and Dignity. My father was visited by my sister for the first time in 1 year, 1 month before the hunger strike. And she told him, "Dad, we can't do this anymore because your health is the only thing that keeps us going." And he looked at her. He told her, "I haven't seen your brothers in years. I haven't been there for your wedding, for your brother's weddings, and I don't know your daughters. Her daughter is 4 years old." And he told her, "This is exactly why I'm going for a hunger strike. The injustice that has been practiced against me and against my fellow prisoners is something that we have to raise our voice for."
Arab, when did you last see your father? How often can you and your brother and sister see your dad, as well as your mother?
I was 11 years old when he was arrested. I used to see him twice a month until I turned 16. After 16, I would see him maybe once every 2 years. I haven't seen my father in 2 years.
Why?
They just don't give me permission to go. And this happens also to my 1 year older brother. My oldest brother, Qassam, has seen him only for 3 times. And Qassam himself was imprisoned for 3.5 years for basically no reason, for being guilty of being the son of Marwan Barghouti. My mother would see him once a month, but sometimes they just don't give her permission for 3 or 4 months.
Earlier this month, the Israel Prison Service released footage of Marwan Barghouti purportedly eating in his cell. Barghouti supporters have said the video was fabricated in an attempt to discredit the hunger strike. Barghouti's wife, Fadwa Barghouti, spoke out against the footage and warned that Israel intends to defeat the hunger strike by all means.
The level the occupation has reached, in my opinion, is a deterioration. Instead of focusing on this video, the world should blame and punish Israel for this ethical deterioration, where they are fabricating a film. We were not surprised because during my last visit to him, I heard from him that they will launch a serious battle against this strike, using all tools and methods to defeat it.
So can you comment on this, Arab? Today is your mom's birthday?
Yeah, it's her birthday, and I send her my love and energy. And
where is she?
She's in Ramallah. She's the one who held my father's message and took it everywhere. And she's the reason why he's recognized internationally. And hopefully next year I'll celebrate her birthday with my father. Regarding the video, let me tell you that I'm his son, and I can't tell it's him in the video. That's first. Even if it's him, my father spent more than 3 years in the solitary confinement, so it can be taken any time. But on the other side, this shows you the amount of desperation that the Israeli government got to put such a cheap and low quality video. And here I just want to say that they posted the video. They put him in the solitary confinement to punish him for the op-ed New York Times article. They did torture him. And the only thing they didn't do is just to meet the demands. This shows you, yeah.
I have 15 seconds. The conditions in the prison.
It's really bad. and we have sick prisoners. We have the administrative detention, which is holding prisoners for years without even visiting the trial court, with not visiting the families. I haven't touched my father in 15 years. This tells you all what the hunger strike is all about.
Arab Agouti, I want to thank you so much for being with us. The son of the Palestinian political leader, now on hunger strike, Marwan Barghouti. He's been in prison for more than 15 years. Arab has recently launched the Saltwater Challenge, asking supporters to express their solidarity with the hunger strikers by posting videos online drinking salt water. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking in Palo Alto, in Santa Cruz, in San Diego, in Los Angeles. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.